New York, this is Democracy Now.
To continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
Minneapolis Police Chief Arredondo and other top police officials testify against former officer Derek Chauvin, accusing him of violating the department's policies by kneeling on the neck of George Floyd for over 9 minutes, killing the 46-year-old father. We'll air excerpts from the Chauvin murder trial and speak to Mark Claxton, former NYPD officer who now heads the Black Law Enforcement Alliance. Then we talk to journalist Victoria Law about her new book, Prisons Make Us Safer, and 20 other myths about mass incarceration.
The United States has 5% of the world's population, but 20 to 25% of the world's prison population. If prisons kept us safer, then we should be the safest nation in the world. But prisons don't keep us safer, and they do not prevent violence. Just as fear of imprisonment did not prevent Derek Chauvin from killing George Floyd in Minneapolis.
Plus, we look at a historic new union agreement at Rutgers University. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's moved up the deadline for states to make the COVID-19 vaccine available to all adults by April 19th instead of May 1st. This comes as daily cases are on the rise and new variants continue to spread, including the UK variant, which has now been reported in every state and could account for 70% of cases in Michigan, which is seeing a major surge. The U.S. has now delivered over 168 million vaccine doses, the highest number in the world. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says richer countries must urgently combat vast global vaccine inequities.
Scaling up production and equitable distribution remains the major barrier to ending the acute stage of this pandemic. It is a travesty that in some countries, health workers and those at risk groups remain completely unvaccinated.
Brazil recorded over 4,000 daily COVID-19 deaths for the first time, bringing its total death toll to nearly 337,000, second only to the United States. India's reported a record of nearly 116,000 new cases Wednesday, taking its total caseload to 12.8 million, the third highest in the world after Brazil and the United States. Four witnesses took the stand Tuesday in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who killed George Floyd last May. Minneapolis Police Department trainer Johnny Mercil testified Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck was not a trained restraint and that officers are instructed to only use force that's proportional to a threat. This is Mercil answering questions from the prosecution.
So if there was, say, for example, the subject was under control and handcuffed, would this be authorized?
I would say no.
We'll have the latest on the trial after headlines with Marquez Claxton of the Black Law Enforcement Alliance. Arkansas has become the first state to criminalize gender-affirming treatment for transgender youth after state lawmakers voted Tuesday to override Governor Asa Hutchinson's veto of the highly contested bill. The ACLU is suing over the new law, which it says will have deadly consequences. In Missouri, Tashara Jones has become the first Black woman ever elected as St. Louis mayor. She addressed supporters yesterday at a victory speech.
I will not stay silent when I spot racism. I will not stay silent when I spot homophobia or transphobia. I will not stay silent when I spot xenophobia.
Jones has also advocated a shift from incarceration to supporting prevention efforts. She's served as city treasurer since 2013 and was a Missouri state representative for 5 years. Florida Democratic Congressmember Alcy Hastings has died at the age of 84 after a battle with pancreatic cancer. Hastings, a former lawyer and Florida's first African-American federal judge, had served in Congress for nearly four decades, where he championed civil rights. A special election will be scheduled to fill his seat. In legislative news, the Senate parliamentarian ruled Democrats can use budget reconciliation again during this fiscal year, meaning they can advance more of President Biden's agenda, such as the recently unveiled $2 trillion infrastructure plan with a simple majority, bypassing a Republican filibuster. U.S. and Iranian officials expressed optimism following the start of constructive talks in Vienna aimed at reviving the landmark 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, which the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from in 2018 under former President Trump, reimposing harsh sanctions on Iran. The two sides are meeting indirectly through the remaining parties in the nuclear accord. This is an Iranian government spokesperson.
We are confident that we are on the right track, and if America's will, seriousness, and honesty is proven, it could be a good sign for a better future, a future of peace and security for the region and the world.
Meanwhile, an Iranian military vessel appears to have been attacked Tuesday in the Red Sea by an Israeli mine. The New York Times reports Israeli officials notified the U.S. that Israel was responsible for the attack. It was the latest in a series of naval attacks between Israel and Iran. The UN is warning over 27 million people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, one-third of the population, are facing acute hunger driven by ongoing conflict and the COVID-19 pandemic. The World Food Program says it needs at least $660 million to maintain its aid to the DRC, which has the highest number of people in urgent need of food assistance in the world. Amnesty International USA is calling on the Biden administration to cease its, quote, outdated and destructive, unquote, policy of developing and deploying anti-personnel landmines. The statement was issued after the Pentagon confirmed this week the U.S. would not change its position on landmines. 164 countries have signed on to the 1997 mine ban treaty. The U.S. is not one of them. Over 2,000 people were killed in 2019. By anti-personnel mines. In the occupied West Bank, mourners attended the funeral of Osama Mansour, a 42-year-old Palestinian man killed by Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint Tuesday. Soldiers say Mansour tried to ram his vehicle into them, but his wife, who was also in the car and sustained bullet fragment wounds, disputes the claim.
They told us to switch off the car and park it. We switched it off and parked there. He only asked us where we are coming from and where we are going. That was it. Then he told us to go, leave. We switched the car on and left. And within seconds, four soldiers started shooting at us from behind.
The mayor of Bidu village, where Osama Mansour lives, says the shooting may be brought to the International Criminal Court, which is investigating war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. In Washington, D.C., six Yemeni American activists have been on hunger strike for 9 days, protesting the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war and blockade that have crippled Yemen's economy and created the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The hunger strikers, who are members of the grassroots group Yemeni Liberation Movement, are demanding an end to all U.S. support for the blockade and for President Biden to pressure Saudi Arabia to end the war. A warning to our audience, the next story contains descriptions of sexual violence. In Oklahoma, an investigation is underway after a soldier at the Fort Sill Army training base said she was sexually assaulted by 22 service members, sometimes in groups. At least 20 personnel at Fort Sill have been suspended. Speaking to The Intercept, an Army official referred to the case as Fort Hood 2.0, referencing the sexual harassment and killing last April of 20-year-old soldier Vanessa Guillen by a fellow service member. The New York Times is reporting Florida Congressmember Matt Gaetz sought blanket preemptive pardons for himself and congressional allies in the final weeks of President Trump's term. Gaetz was already under investigation by the Trump Department of Justice for sex trafficking. In climate news, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere surpassed 420 parts per million for the first time in recorded history. The measurement puts the planet roughly at the halfway point on the path to doubling pre-industrial carbon dioxide levels. The reading was taken at the Mauna Loa Observatory on the Big Island of Hawaii this past weekend. And in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo and lawmakers struck a deal Tuesday to create a $2.1 billion assistance fund for workers excluded from federal benefits during the pandemic, many of them undocumented. Excluded workers organized for months, with some taking part in a hunger strike for over 21 days to protest the unjust system. Advocates hailed the deal, which is part of the state's proposed $212 billion budget, as a major victory, but some warn the measure contains burdensome proof of employment requirements, which can be harder for undocumented workers and those in informal jobs to provide. To see our interview on the subject, you can go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin is entering its eighth day. Chauvin is charged with second and third degree murder, as well as manslaughter, for killing George Floyd last May. Over the past 3 days, numerous members of the Minneapolis Police Department accused Chauvin of violating department policy by kneeling on Floyd's neck for 9.5 minutes while ignoring pleas from Floyd that he could not breathe. Minneapolis Police Chief Arredondo testified against his officer in a rare move. Here he's being questioned by prosecutor Steve Schleicher.
When do you believe, or do you have a belief as to when this restraint, the restraint on the ground that you viewed, should have stopped?
Once Mr. Floyd, and this is based on my viewing of the videos, once Mr. Floyd had stopped resisting, and certainly once he was in distress and trying to verbalize that, that should have stopped. There's an initial reasonableness in trying to just get him under control in the first few seconds, but once there was no longer any resistance, and clearly when Mr. Floyd was no longer responsive and even motionless, to continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
Madeira Arredondo is Minneapolis's first Black police chief. He was also questioned about the decision by Chauvin and the other officers not to administer first aid.
Did you see the defendant or any of the officers attempt to provide first aid to Mr. Floyd?
I did not see any of the defendants try to attempt to provide first aid to Mr. Floyd.
And based on these observations, do you have an opinion as to whether the defendant violated MPD departmental policy 7-350 by failing to render aid to Mr. Floyd?
I agree that the defendant violated our policy in terms of rendering aid.
The emergency room doctor who tried to save George Floyd's life at a Minneapolis emergency room testified Monday that Floyd likely died from a lack of oxygen. Dr. Bradford Langenfeld said Floyd's heart had already stopped beating by the time he arrived at the hospital. During questioning by prosecutor Jerry Blackwell, the doctor said George Floyd's chances of living would have been higher if CPR had been administered sooner.
Is the administration of CPR right away important for you to know when you're dealing with a patient who has suffered cardiac arrest? Is important for you to know about that?
It is, in the sense that it informs the likelihood of survival.
And what do you mean by that, Dr. Langenfeld?
It's well known that any amount of time that a patient spends in cardiac arrest without immediate CPR markedly decreases the chance of a good outcome.
Was your leading theory then for the cause of Mr. Floyd's cardiac arrest oxygen deficiency?
That was one of the more likely possibilities. I felt that at the time, based on the information I had, it was more likely than the other possibilities.
And doctor, is there another name for death by oxygen deficiency?
Asphyxia is a commonly understood term.
The former head of the Minneapolis Police Department's field training division, Katie Blackwell, also testified Monday. During questioning, she accused Eric Chauvin of violating the department's use of force policy, a warning this contains graphic images of police violence.
Is this a trained technique that's by the Minneapolis Police Department when you were overseeing the training unit?
It is not.
And why not?
Well, use of force, according to policy, has to be, you know, consistent with MPD training. And what we train are neck restraints, the conscious and unconscious neck restraint. So per policy, a neck restraint is compressing one or both sides of the neck using an arm or leg. But what we train is using one arm or two arm to do a neck restraint.
And how does this differ?
I don't know what kind of improvised position that is. So that's not what we train.
To talk more about the trial of Derek Chauvin, we're joined by Mark Claxton, retired New York Police Department detective, now serves as the director of the Black Law Enforcement Alliance. He joins us from Columbia, South Carolina. Mark, thanks so much for being with us. Well, let's start off with this challenge to the blue wall of science. A lieutenant, a commander, a training officer, the police chief himself, condemning the actions of Chauvin. Yet at the same time, this officer, Derek Chauvin, worked for something like 19 years with 18 complaints against him. Why was he even in the field? So if you could address both of those.
Well, it is significant that there is some testimony for the prosecutors against the interests of Derek Chauvin. But as you point out, this is an officer who comes with a history, a documented history, one that we may not have an opportunity, we will not have an opportunity to hear much about in court because of the judge's rulings. But what's happening now is a presentation, the prosecutor's presentation, utilizing a lot of the information on procedures and policies in the departments, and some of the police representatives, of course, are reflexively defending their organization and the integrity of the profession itself. However, I will say that Chief Arredondo, the leader of Minneapolis Police, really has shown, has set a particular standard about professional excellence, et cetera, and intolerance of certain conduct. From the very beginning, he was clear in his decision to terminate all the officers involved. He's been on the record about the relationship or discontinuing the relationship with the labor union there, the police union. And so he seems to be a more progressive-minded police professional. But history has shown us that the systems are very resilient and they tend to snap back to the way things always are.
And Mark Claxton, I wanted to ask you, before the trial began, Minneapolis reached a civil settlement with the Floyd family of $27 million. To what extent do you think the decision to reach a civil settlement even before the criminal trial, in essence, freed the department and its personnel to be so openly and so unusually participating in the prosecution side of the case?
It really freed them tremendously because they realized that there was no probability or possibility that those individuals would come back into the ranks of the police department. But what really freed them were Chief Arredondo's statements days after the video became public and he became aware of the video, because his actions indicated a certain intolerance that resonated throughout the department. And that, in essence, is what's really important about progressive leadership, especially in law enforcement. I'm under no illusions that there is some sea change afoot, that there is some significant reform movement across the nation, although I think there's significant efforts, and I support all of those efforts for improving the relationship between police and communities, but more importantly, making criminal justice agencies, police agencies more efficient. But as I indicated, history tells us that there is a certain stubborn resilience within policing that will continue this cycle of toxic police culture that too often leads to fatal encounters with primarily black and brown people.
And speaking about that resilience that you've mentioned, the issue of, because as you note, there may be particular individuals like the Minneapolis police chief who at a given moment will try to affect change. But what can lead to structural change? As you know, for years, and we've discussed this in the past, how African-American police officers groups within these various departments have struggled for a more progressive view, but have always to some degree been beaten back by the existing white-dominated police unions. What would lead to real structural or systemic change?
A couple of things, and some of them are important even in this particular case, but what really would lead to the most significant change, a cultural change in policing, a behavioral change for individual police officers, is to expose them to additional liability. You know, the elimination of qualified immunity, for example, is significant because once you have police officers feel that they are personally vulnerable and, more importantly, personally responsible for their conduct, you'll find that they'll adjust their methods and their perceptions of people. And also, in line with that, once you actually arrest, convict, and sentence police officers consistent with how you sentence individuals outside of law enforcement for crimes that they committed under the color of law, you'll see that there will be a significant shift in how police respond and react. Right now, we've had cases before where there have been arrests, there have been prosecutions. Most of those cases end up with no sentencing, no convictions. And that's significant. It is supportive of toxic police culture when you allow your law enforcement professionals to, in essence, get away with it. So that would significantly shift the culture. And also, dealing straightforward with the police unions. Chief Arredondo in Minneapolis, once again, has led the way in this regard. They decided after this particular incident, this was just, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back for them. They decided to eliminate the police union as the negotiating agent for the officers right off the bat. That's something that really should be replicated in other jurisdictions, because police unions should not be going beyond the health and welfare and the salaries, the benefits of their particular members. When you have unions and organizations allowed to tamper with, create a right policy, police policy, you know, it's bound that things are going to go wrong. So those three things could significantly change the police culture.
I wanted to go back to Memorial Day, the day that this white officer, Derek Chauvin, is on trial for murdering George Floyd, and go before that to the other officers. You have the situation where at the Cup Foods, a cashier thinks a bill is counterfeit. Not clear if George Floyd knew this at all. And now that cashier lives with enormous regret that he ever did anything in alerting his, the supervisors at the store. But jurors have also been shown police body cam footage of Officer Thomas Lane pulling a gun on Floyd. Now, again, they've been called for a counterfeit bill, pulling a gun on him within seconds of approaching Floyd's car. A warning to our audience, the video is disturbing.
Let me see your hands.
Right now. Let me see your other hand.
All right. What I do though?
What do we do?
Put your hand up there.
Step out of the vehicle and step away from me, all right? Step out and face away. Step out and face away.
Okay, Mr. Officer, please don't shoot me. Please, man.
I'm not going to shoot you. Step out and face away.
I'm going to get out of here, man. Please don't shoot me, man.
I'm not shooting you, man.
Please, man. I just lost my mom, man.
Taking one off. Step out and face away. Step out and face away.
Please don't shoot me, Mr. Officer. Please don't shoot me, man.
From the beginning, you have George Floyd pleading for his life. He doesn't know why the cops have pulled a gun on him and are pulling him out of his car. Marcus Claxton, can you talk about this kind of policing and then this issue of the three of them, not just Chauvin, with their knees on his back and holding his legs while he is handcuffed with his hands behind his back?
Over the past a day or two, they've been discussing during the course of the trial certain concepts within policing training concepts. They've discussed proportionality. They've discussed the use of force continuum, which basically is the amount of force that you use when you're dealing in particular situations, and proportionality, whether or not the amount of force you're using is proportional, is correctly proportional to the resistance, quote unquote, that you are receiving. What we know and what we've experienced, what we've documented, what's been established is that those theories of proportionality don't apply when police deal with black people. We've seen it time and time again that there is an excess of force used when dealing with black people, regardless of the offense. Here you have an allegation of an alleged counterfeit bill, which is a nothing situation. It really is a nothing issue, what should be a simple routine police response involving no force at all turns into a killing on the street with other police officers involved in that killing. And I think that they haven't been appropriately charged for their involvement as well. And also what you have are individuals outside of policing, civilian witnesses, who are more concerned about the sanctity of human life, something else that came up during the trial, more interested in the humanity of George Floyd, more interested in protecting and preserving George Floyd's life than the police officers, the trained, quote-unquote, professional police officers on the scene who took an oath to protect and preserve human life. There was a role reversal, but it happens because of the disproportionate amount of force, the disproportionate killing of black people by police. It's race-based, and until we come to that realization, until we acknowledge that, until we accept it and begin to work through it and begin to eliminate it by arresting, charging, and convicting police officers, these tragedies will continue to occur.
And Mark, I wanted to ask you about something we mentioned earlier, the history of complaints against Derek Chauvin, 18 complaints in a 19-year career as a police officer. Now, admittedly, many of them were not upheld complaints, but that is not unusual because departments rarely do really good investigations of these complaints. But I'm wondering, from your own experience, what's the normal track record for officers in terms of receiving complaints, and what's the modus operandi of how these are dealt with by most departments?
Well, you see, there is no normal for complaints. It really depends on where you work, how you operate, what units you're involved in. You know, some units, you're really removed from contact with the public on a regular basis, individual contact with the public. Other units, you're more exposed. It also depends on your personality, what you bring into it. You know, some people are super hyper, super aggressive, and have these interactions that are not respectful. So they're going to tend to get more complaints. I think what's really insulting is the fact that much of the history of Derek Chauvin, and we're touching on it here, is not allowed into the courtroom. But all these kind of accusations and allegations against the victim, George Floyd, are allowed. So his history is significant and substantive enough to bring into the courtroom. But the defendant charged with murder, two separate counts of murder, is kind of protected because the judge felt that it was more provocative than probing. And I think that really is a shame. But it's typical of a criminal justice system that disproportionately and negatively affects Black and brown people.
Finally, I wanted to turn to another subject, Mark, being that you're a former New York City police officer, front page piece in the New York Times, DA to void up to 90 convictions tied to fired New York detective Joseph Franco, because now he has been indicted on a number of counts, videotape that shows that drug deals he said took place never took place. They are throwing out up to 90 convictions tied to him. And, of course, it's expected that many of them will be indictments of Black and Latino people. Can you talk about the significance of this?
It's hugely significant. And that particular Franco case really ties into something that was that happened in Brooklyn during the time when Ken Thompson was the DA there and him reviewing cases of another detective, Louis Scarsella, in Brooklyn, and the amount of cases that were kicked out because of various infractions allegedly committed by then detective Scarsella. Listen, when people lose confidence and faith in the systems that are supposed to supply justice, then society is in peril. And you can't have a system set up where those who represent the ideas of justice, the ideals of justice, operate outside of the law and penalize innocent people. And so it is hugely significant whenever that occurs. And all the district attorney's offices really should be reviewing cases, because many of them now have their own lists of individual police officers, law enforcement officials, who they deem to be not credible. They should review all cases assigned to all of those individuals just to ensure that the application of justice is fair.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Marquez Claxton, retired New York Police Department detective, now director of the Black Law Enforcement Alliance. When we come back, we speak with journalist Victoria Law about her new book, Prisons Make Us Safer, and 20 other myths about mass incarceration. Stay with us.
I know that my Savior lives, and at the end, He will stand on this earth. My flesh may be destroyed, yet from this body, I will see God. Yes, I will see Him for myself, and I long for that moment. Grandma, I really miss you, and it ain't been the same. I drop a tear when I hear your name. Mariella Holloway, why you gotta be so far away? Used to say, don't worry, it's gonna be okay. But it ain't, it's like when you left, you took the Lord with you. Why couldn't I come when He came to get you? Damn, I really miss you. I had to say it again. I remember the time when I was like 10. Crept up in the neighbor's yard, yeah, being hard-headed. You told me I would get it, you said it. Boy, did I get it. But after you spanked me, you hugged me, kissed me on my forehead.
I Miss You by DMX, featuring Faith Evans. Rapper DMX is currently on life support and in a coma. Hundreds have gathered outside his White Plains hospital in a makeshift vigil. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Next month will mark 1 year since George Floyd was killed by the white Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who knelt on Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes while ignoring pleas from Floyd that he could not breathe. He was aided in this by three other officers. Floyd's death sparked a national discussion about defunding the police. In the latest example of the backlash to this push, conservative Republican Senator Tom Cotton responded Tuesday to a CNN report on a rise in crime in 2020 by tweeting that the solution was to, quote, lock them up, and adding, quote, we have a major under-incarceration problem in America, and it's only getting worse, Cotton said. In fact, the United States has the world's highest incarceration rate. It's home to less than 5% of the global population, yet has nearly 25% of the world's prisoners, more than 2 million people, a disproportionate number of them Black and Latinx. Over the past 40 years, the number of people behind bars in the United States has increased by 500%. Much of this is addressed in a new book by journalist Victoria Law, published the same day as Senator Cotton's misinformed tweet. Her book is called Prisons Make Us Safer and 20 Other Myths About Incarceration. Through research and interviews with incarcerated people, she identifies myths such as incarceration is necessary to keep our society safe. Last year, she co-authored Prison by Any Other Name, The Harmful Consequences of Popular Reforms. Victoria, welcome back to Democracy Now! Congratulations on the release of your book. We were just talking about the Derek Chauvin murder trial. He was supposedly attempting to arrest George Floyd. Your book is such a critical book when looking at the whole defund the police and abolition movement. Can you lay out its thesis and apply it to what we're dealing with today?
Yes. We have the prevailing myth in the United States that we need prisons and mass incarceration to keep us safer. And after listening to the last segment, we should ask, why do we think prisons keep us safe? I mean, obviously, Derek Chauvin wasn't afraid of being arrested or imprisoned when he killed George Floyd. The officers around him were not afraid of prison when they did nothing. None of them thought that they would be held accountable, let alone imprisoned, because people do not think about imprisonment when as a deterrent to crime or violence. If we think about the ways in which we act on a daily basis, we don't go around assaulting people, not because we are afraid of imprisonment, but because we don't go around assaulting people. So the book lays out myths about mass incarceration, the fact that they keep us safer, as Tom Cotton erroneously asserted, as well as some of the underlying myths about what causes mass incarceration and what the reality is behind bars.
I'm wondering if you could talk about the mental health aspect of the mass incarceration issue. As the United States went into deinstitutionalization of mental health patients in the 90s, there was a corresponding increase of the prison population. And I'm this trend toward treating people with mental problems by imprisoning them.
Yes. Well, what we see is that there was a deinstitutionalization movement in the starting in the 1970s, much of it led by people who had been institutionalized at some point in their lives, because the institutions themselves were terrible and horrific and abusive. And at the same time as the deinstitutionalization movement, we also saw some cuts starting to happen under neoliberalism and Reagan. So the supports and assistance that people need, regardless of their mental health status, such as access to safe and affordable housing, medical care, mental health care out in the communities, were also being viciously slashed. And what we see instead is that criminalization takes its place. So people are arrested for criminalized behavior, which if you have mental illness and you are homeless, you are more likely to be arrested because you're just out in public all the time. You are more likely to not get mental health services. And we have this idea that you get mental health treatment when you are inside jails or prisons, which is not the case. If there is mental health treatment, it is often in the form of medications. Mental health caseloads are overloaded, and people often cycle in and out of jails for petty offenses due to their mental illness and their poverty.
And Victoria, the role of the mass media in creating the myth of the need for prisons and for law enforcement work. I mean, every other show on television, or even when you go to the Netflix or the other streaming services, are the glorification of police or former police or crime fighters. This is the staple of so much of American entertainment.
Yes. What we have is a glorification, but it's also from very from a young age, we are always told that police make us safer. Prisons are necessary to lock away the bad guys. And there's very little questioning of it from the school seminars that you get in grade school and beyond, of if you are lost or you're in danger, find a police officer, to all these shows that glorify police officers as the people who stop crime and stop harm and danger from happening. But in reality, policing and imprisonment happens after something bad or something violent has happened. It usually doesn't happen before. And as we see in the case of Derek Chauvin killing George Floyd, police officers can also bring, and often do bring, violence into the picture where previously there was none. At the same time, we're also bombarded by news segments that show crime every night, because this is what draws viewers in, is this lurid attraction to watching what looks like a human train wreck every night on the television news. And that adds to people's fears about their personal safety and the fact that they want to feel safe. People want to feel safe, and the media feeds into that by showing them time after time attacks on people, shootings, killings, and other types of violence.
Some call it copaganda. Your book is called Prisons Make Us Safe and 20 Other Myths About Mass Incarceration. Can you go through those myths and start with the issue of drugs? I mean, we just played in our music break DMX, who is in a coma, who was arrested many times, clearly has a major problem with drugs. Clearly, prison has not been the answer.
Yes. I mean, you've discussed on the show many times how you've had guests on the show discuss drugs and how prisons don't address drug addiction or substance use addiction. It doesn't address any of the underlying causes. I remember a few years ago you had Susan Burton, who I write about in the book, who was in and out of jail and prison and prison-like drug rehabs for decades of her life, none of which addressed the underlying traumas, the childhood sexual abuse she had endured, and the death of her five-year-old son when a police officer ran him over and was never held accountable for killing her son. None of this addressed that. And instead, she was continually locked up. And instead of help, she just got incarceration. And we see this so often, particularly with low-income people and Black and brown people, is that they are criminalized for substance use instead of either having the root causes of their substance use examined if it is a problem, or to simply say, okay, they're, you know, using substances, but they're still able to function in society. But instead, with our incarceration policies, we criminalize drug use and we treat it as a social and dangerous problem rather than a public health issue or simply somebody else's personal use.
And what about the alternatives, the existing alternatives to people who commit crimes, whether it's probation, parole, electronic monitoring? Are they effective alternatives? Why or why not?
These alternatives that are very popular, electronic monitoring, probation, parole, as you just named, often expand the prison system into our homes and communities. So instead of somebody being held in a physical jail or prison, they are instead in their homes under house arrest, which is very different than shelter at home, which we've all experienced this past year, where you have to get prior permission to leave your house and to go places. And if you do not, you end up very likely with the threat of being sent back to jail or to prison. So there are many, many requirements that normal people don't have to face, or normally people don't have to face if they're not under supervision. And these are not necessarily crimes that people commit when they are sent back to jail or to prison, but it could be actions like missing a meeting, coming home past curfew. Curfews could be as early as 8 o'clock at night. Now tell me which adult wants to come home promptly at 7:59 every night. And these are actions that could land somebody back in prison for a violation of their electronic monitoring, probation, or parole. And
Just as we wrap, I wanted to ask you about the whole issue of violence against the Asian American community. New York police have arrested a man who viciously attacked a 65-year-old Filipino woman near Times Square as she was walking to church just a few weeks ago. Video footage shows the man kick the woman in her stomach, then repeatedly stomped on her face while she reportedly, while he was yelling anti-Asian slurs. The assailant, who has a history of dozens of arrests for violent behavior, walked away as bystanders, including security guards at a luxury apartment building, did nothing in response. Both security guards at the luxury hotel have now been at the luxury building have now been fired. But as an Asian American reporter, when you saw the attacks that took place in Atlanta, the murders, Victoria, immediately you had people like Mayor de Blasio saying he's sending more cops in to protect Asian Americans. What was your response?
I think that what we need to remember is that when we rely on police and solely on police and prisons to keep us safer, we end up being complicit in what the doormen of the luxury building did, which was they did nothing. They thought, well, you know, somebody else will deal with it, because it shrinks our ability to imagine ourselves as bystanders. And at the same time, the man who assaulted the 65-year-old had a history of arrests. He also had a prior prison sentence for killing his mother when he was 19 years old. And records show that a few months before he killed his mother, police were called to his house because he was experiencing a mental health crisis. Clearly, the police did not address the mental health crisis because they are not mental health workers. Prison did not address his violent behavior because he came out and assaulted a 65-year-old woman. It did not address and perhaps exacerbated his racism because he was yelling anti-Asian slurs. So what we need to remember is that prisons are not actually addressing any of the root causes. They don't help people get better, and they often help make people worse.
Victoria Law, we want to thank you for being with us, journalist and author of the new book, Prisons Make Us Safer, and 20 Other Myths About Mass Incarceration. When we come back, we will look at an historic union agreement at Rutgers University. Stay with us. You've got to go down and join the union by the late legendary folk singer Pete Seeger and the Song Swappers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, and the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. After a year of layoffs, cuts, and austerity, the faculty and staff of four unions at Rutgers University, where our co-host Juan Gonzalez is a professor of journalism and media studies, have voted in support of an unusual pioneering agreement to protect jobs and guarantee raises after the school declared fiscal emergency as a result of the pandemic. A key part of the deal is an agreement by the professors to do work share and take a slight cut in hours for a few months in order to save the jobs of other lower paid workers. This is journalist and Rutgers University professor Naomi Klein speaking ahead of the vote at a town hall meeting sponsored by the Coalition of Rutgers Unions last week.
This tentative agreement is the product of a year-long fight for a people-centered alternative in the pandemic crisis. When management turned to layoffs and austerity last spring, the 19 unions of the Coalition of Rutgers Unions came together to develop an alternative approach that saves jobs, protects the vulnerable, and centers the university's core mission of teaching, research, and service.
Well, as of last night, all four unions at Rutgers have now ratified the memorandum of agreement with the university by overwhelming rates. And it will be implemented, affecting 10,000 workers across the university. For more, we're joined by two people who spearheaded the agreement: Todd Wolfson, president of the Rutgers Faculty, Grad Workers, and Postdoc Union, and Christine O'Connell, president of the Union of Rutgers Administrators, American Federation of Teachers, which represents 2,700 administrative staff at the university. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Todd Wolfson, let's begin with you. Talk about what exactly was agreed to and the historic nature of this agreement.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. So what was agreed to was our core demand was no layoffs of staff and stopping the layoffs that they had begun. And so that core demand was met, and there's no layoffs through the end of the calendar year into next year. We also called on a fair and just reappointment process. About 20 to 25% of our adjunct faculty were laid off in the midst of this crisis, and we want them back to pre-pandemic numbers, and we have a process that will get them back to those numbers. We also made a demand that our doctoral students, who do much of the teaching and much of the critical research of the university, that our doctoral students who are facing invisible layoffs are given a one-year extension funded. Now, we didn't get that for all of our doctoral students, but the ones who are coming off funding will get that extension if their work has been impacted by the pandemic. And then we also won our raises back. And in exchange for those things, we have agreed to a work share program. And the work share program is, it doesn't mean we're sharing work among workers, but rather that the federal and state government and the employer Rutgers share the cost of employees. So it takes some of the burden of the cost of employees off of Rutgers, and it's part of the American Relief, the American Recovery Act, and that some of that cost is then shared with the federal and state government so that Rutgers sees some savings. So we're in effect furloughed at either 10 or 20% of our time through the end of June.
Now, Todd, I wanted to ask you about when the university first voided all the contracts unilaterally by declaring a fiscal emergency in the midst of the pandemic. Could you talk about the union's effort to try to get the university to be more transparent about what the actual dollar figures were on the fiscal emergency that they were claiming? The union had to go to court, didn't it?
The union had to go to court on multiple occasions, but in particular, what you're referring to is we were trying to get information about a massive growth in the athletic subsidy in the university, a jump in numbers of $100 million over one fiscal year. And so we were calling on them to give us the information. They stonewalled us, and so we took them to court. We won in court and got the majority of that information. And the context here is that Rutgers is spending, you know, over the course of 10 years, $200 to $300 million on their athletics program in subsidies to that athletics program, which is about the amount of, or probably more than what they're facing in terms of economic problems due to the pandemic. And yet, in response to the pandemic, they've laid off 1,000 workers, stolen raises, et cetera. And so we wanted real transparency about that. So that was a consistent battle to force Rutgers to be clear and transparent about where the money is coming from and where it's going.
And to what degree, Todd, do you think the new leadership at the university, Jonathan Holloway, the first African-American president in Rutgers history, came in the middle of this pandemic in July 1? Did he have any kind of major impact on the ability of the union to reach a settlement?
We hope so. It's not entirely clear, but we're cautiously optimistic about President Holloway's role in this. There has been a pivot under the new administration. We have been calling on what we call a people-centered alternative to the pandemic for a year now. And Jonathan Holloway came into office about 9 months ago, so in the midst of this fight. The past president, Robert Barchi, ignored our calls. We said that we would furlough and work share in order to stop layoffs. We offered them $100 million in savings to stop layoffs across the university, and they still did those layoffs and ignored us. It's taken us another 9 months under President Holloway to get to this point, but we have gotten here. So, we could talk more about why this is so important, but we think that President Holloway has played an important role.
I wanted to bring Christine O'Connell into the conversation, president of the Union of Rutgers Administrators, American Federation of Teachers. Your union voted last night. Explain exactly what you voted for. And also, can you talk about what happens with the staff, like the cleaning crews, the janitors? How have the support staff been impacted by this agreement?
Thank you, Amy and Juan, for having me. Good morning. The historic nature of this agreement is that it encompasses all four unions, right? It impacts all of us differently, but jointly. I represent maintenance staff in addition to administrative staff in every academic department. We've seen layoffs in academic departments. We've seen layoffs in libraries during the pandemic and at the largest research university in New Jersey. And our maintenance staff, we've been advocating for health and safety protocols, transparency in providing PPE and securing definitive protocols that they should follow as well to protect themselves as well as protect others on campus. So this agreement protects jobs, right? We are using this as leverage, hopefully, to protect folks from losing their income, their health benefits, and for many in the staff unions, tuition remission for their dependent children. Because that is a vital benefit for those who don't earn, a lot of money.
And Christine, the ability of the four unions to negotiate together, how unusual is that? And how much of an impact did that have on the administration that the various unions, even though they had different income levels and different types of jobs, managed to stay together at the bargaining table?
I think that solidarity is a word that is used frequently, but we showed what it actually means in practice. Having multiple unions advocate for each other and understand each other's needs is key. And management, I think, has a much better understanding that in order for Rutgers to work, Rutgers workers work. And I think that has been made clear. And I do give credit to Jonathan Holloway because he referenced the beloved community. We are the beloved community, all of us, staff, faculty, students. In every aspect of this university, we make up that beloved community.
And before we go, I wanted to ask either of you, Todd, Christine, even Juan, a Rutgers professor, about this latest news. Rutgers was the first of five U.S. colleges and universities that has announced plans to require students be fully vaccinated before they can come back to campus in the fall, with limited exceptions for underlying medical conditions and religious beliefs. How will this be enforced? And what are the thoughts of teachers and other staff on this?
I can jump in and then let Christine and Juan jump in. I mean, for us, we think it's great that the students are going to be vaccinated. We also think the workers should be vaccinated. The university did not reach out to us to talk about this. We think it's important that I certainly think that all my members should be vaccinated. We want a safe campus. We all want a safe campus. Now, how they're going to mandate this and how it's going to work, honestly, there isn't enough transparency between us and the university, so it's hard to know. But from our vantage, faculty certainly skew older, and so we want a safe place if we're going to be in the classroom for our teachers. And so not only should the students be vaccinated, but we want our faculty to be vaccinated as well.
Well, I want to thank— Yes, go ahead, Christine. We have a few
seconds. Just to jump in, we strongly encourage our members to be vaccinated. We are not in support of a mandate for faculty and staff, but we are strongly in support of, we all want a health and safety, health and safe campus to return to, especially as we try to return to post-pandemic life.
Christine O'Connell, president of the Union of Rutgers Administrators, American Federation of Teachers, and Todd Wolfson, Rutgers Union of Grad Workers, Faculty, and Postdocs. Thanks so much for being with us. A happy birthday to Matt Ely. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a senior news producer to join our team here in New York City. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.